Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. The threat to our salvation is the clash of peoples. Jews and Arabs, offspring of a single father, separated in youth by jealousy, in adolescence by fear, in adulthood by power, in old age by habit. It is time to break these habits of hate and create new habits, habits of the heart that will awake within us the causeless love of redemption and peace. These words were written by today's guest. Rabbi Rami Shapiro is an award-winning author, poet, essayist, and educator whose poems have been anthologized in over a dozen volumes and whose prayers are used in prayer books around the world. Rami received rabbinical ordination from the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. A congregational rabbi for 20 years, he is currently adjunct professor of religious studies at Middle Tennessee State University. In addition to writing books, including The Angelic Way, The Divine Feminine in Biblical Wisdom Literature, and The Sacred Art of Loving Kindness, Rami writes a regular column for Spirituality and Health magazine and is an advisor for OurJewishCommunity.org. Rami, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks, Kara. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first, I'd like to inquire a bit of about our guest's personal journey, because each is fascinating in its details. Can I ask you a little bit about your own journey and what led you into your ministry?
Well, you know, I grew up in a modern Orthodox Jewish home, a very observant home, but it never really spoke to me the way it seemed to have, the way it was supposed to. And I started studying Zen Buddhism in high school, and at the age of 16 had something happened to me during meditation. And I got this sense, or at least, you know, when it was happening, I wasn't there, so I really can't describe the actual event, but what was left with me when it ended was this feeling of absolute non-duality between everything. Everything was one thing, totally interconnected. And that was accompanied with a deep sense of joy and gratitude and compassion. And I've spent the next, you know, half century trying to recapture that.
Huh. That's wonderful. Thank you. So it's interesting, though, that you had such a strong experience through Zen, but continued in your traditional path or the path of your childhood in becoming a rabbi.
Yeah, I didn't feel the need to change religions. I added religions, if you like. I mean, I really studied Zen for 10 years very seriously with a primary Zen master and some other teachers. And I have been very involved in the Ramakrishna order of Advaita Vedanta Hinduism, and very involved in the Catholic world through the Daughters of Wisdom, an order of nuns founded in 1703. So I'm very eclectic. Mm. I'm not really concerned about the brand names.
Yes.
I'm concerned about the truth that is embedded in these different traditions and how it can, you know, benefit me personally, but just, you know, benefit the world in general.
Well, thank you. That's just great because, you know, of course, in our world, people are can get very caught up in the brand names and in the essential, you know, ingredients of the brand names and approach faith as sort of this team or that team and kind of leave one team for another team. And you didn't feel the need to do that.
I didn't feel it personally. I don't feel it now. I mean, just in the last couple of months, I've been teaching in Turkey and a Muslim environment. I've been to Rome to teach the Daughters of Wisdom leadership team as their scholar in residence. Mm. I'm off to India to do some work with the Ramakrishna people there. So, yeah, I don't see it as teams, but I think it's presented as teams in many cases and competing teams, and there can only be one winner, and all of that is where the marketing of religion perverts the message.
Yes, yes. And can you share just a little more about that point? Because that's rather important. What is the marketing about?
Well, the marketing is about like any other marketing. It's a product. You're selling Catholicism, you're selling Islam, you're selling Judaism, whatever it happens to be that you're selling, and you want to get market share. So some are more concerned with that than others. Judaism tends to focus its marketing efforts on Jews primarily, and whereas certain branches of Christianity are really looking at the whole world,
right,
as their demographic. But it's based on the notion, sort of a zero-sum idea, that if we're going to win, others have to lose. And the zero-sum idea of winners and losers is built into lots of religions. I mean, there's just one chosen people.
Right.
So Judaism has that. And, you know, where I live here in Middle Tennessee, a lot of the Protestant Christianities are built on the zero-sum idea that we go to heaven and others go to hell, both not just non-Christians, but other kinds of Christians go to hell.
Right, right.
So that dynamic is just part of the human psyche, and we just put it into whatever we create, and when we create religions, we create zero-sum religions. But on a deeper level, there is the message at the heart of all of these traditions, and I have to be careful because I don't want to give the impression that, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism all say the same thing. They don't.
Right, right.
They're all very different. They all have their own uniqueness, and they should be honored with that. But I think they're all, eventually, and when you look at the mystics, all the mystics from these different traditions are pointing in the same direction, and they're pointing to a realization that everything is a manifestation of the one thing, whether you call it God or Tao or, you know, whatever you're going to call it. But there's only that singular reality, and each one of us is a part of it. And the mystics, I would argue, the mystics tend to point in that direction.
Yes, and we're going to delve a little deeper into that in a little bit, because I enjoy that very much as well. But what gives you strength in the practice of your faith? I mean, you're a rabbi who influenced and involved with other faiths, but what's your favorite part? Where does your strength and joy come from?
Well, I think the way to answer that is through the various practices that I do, I find myself confronted with the divine. In Judaism, we have these different levels, and other religions too, but in Judaism, there are these different levels of consciousness. And at one level, there is a sense of otherness, and you can have a dialogue with the divine. So Martin Buber's I-Thou kind of idea, where you begin to see God as other, but also is manifest in the others, you know, people, animals, etc. And there's a part of my practice where I do find myself in conversation with the divine, and that gives me tremendous strength. And then there are other parts where it goes, I would say, deeper or higher, whichever you prefer, where I go beyond the I-Thou to the simple dissolution of the egoic self and whatever happens when that's not there. And when I come back from that kind of short-lived moment of encounter or awakening, that's where the joy comes from. So the strength still comes from a sense of otherness, and the joy comes from a sense of non-duality. And I don't think you have to go with one or the other. I think you can actually manage both.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, you say, and I love this, Judaism is my mother tongue. Yet in matters of the spirit, I strive to be multilingual. In the end, however, the deepest language of the soul is silence. We discussed that a fair amount here on the program over the years. Can you please share about your experience of silence, or the experience of silence, as a place where we connect?
Yeah, I would be happy to do that. If it's okay, let me just back up a little bit.
Sure.
And take the first part of what you quoted as well. You know, I teach comparative religion, and when I do, the paradigm I use is that religions are like languages, and all languages is human, you know, created by people, and all languages at last, you know, function as long as there's a people to speak them, and each language has its own nuance. You know, there are things you can say in German because of the way you can sort of make words by compounding nouns. There are things you can say in German that you just can't say in English, and things right. you can say in French that you can't say in German. And certainly in Chinese and Sanskrit, there are just ways of articulating things that other languages with their own grammars don't allow. So the more languages you know, the richer your, or the more nuanced your experience of life can be, because it just awakens you to things that your language doesn't allow you to notice. So I look at religions in that sense. No language is true. No language is false. Some languages are better for one thing than another, and you might right. look at religion that way also. So it's not a matter of who's right or who's wrong. It's just knowing as many as possible to become as nuanced as possible in your ability to experience and then articulate your experience of the world. But it's still all talk.
Right. And even if you have six words for snow.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
There's still something deeper. And I really learned this. I mean, I probably knew it from books or something intellectually, but in the early 80s, I was invited by Father Thomas Keating at Snowmass Monastery to join what he ultimately called the Snowmass Group. And at the time, it was, if I remember right, there were 12 of us, contemplatives from 12 different traditions that he invited to spend a week at a time every year at his monastery in Snowmass. Mm-hmm. And the first time I went, there was one rule, in a sense. He said that you cannot speak for your tradition, but you can speak from it. So I couldn't, you know, say, well, we Jews believe, but I could say my experience within the Jewish context is X, Y, or Z.
Right.
And our practice for that week was to follow the life of the monks. So we got up when they got up, and we, you know, went to the various services. But we also spent a lot of time in silence. And what I think happened, from what I experienced anyway, from being with them, I was an annual member, I mean, I went every year for years, was when we came out of these periods of silence, even though we were each speaking with our own language, we were all addressing the same experience. At least that's how it seemed. It didn't matter whether you believed in God or you didn't believe in God or you were a Trinitarian or not. It was irrelevant because the experience was something other than what can be articulated in our theologies. And so we were using language, but we all recognized every time we came out of those silent periods that we weren't really doing justice. I mean, it's the opening line of the Tao Te Ching, that the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao.
Right.
So any God you can make a theology about just really isn't God.
Right.
And whatever that reality is, you can't say. And when we all come to that place of not saying, but of experience, I think that's what a mystic does. You experience the divine or reality directly. There's no conflict there. And there's just a humility that emerges on a number of levels. One, because you realize you're so small and reality is so big. But also the humility of realizing you cannot articulate this accurately, that everything is an approximation. And while some are willing to go to war over these approximations, I'm not. And I think authentic mystics from any given tradition are those who realize that these creeds and theologies are approximations, and they are historically driven and culturally driven, and they're all limited by human imagination. But ultimately what we're pointing at is something else that we can't say. And that just humbles us and allows us to become sisters and brothers with one another.
Yes, thank you. It seems like perhaps we all have a glimpse, and it's our own glimpse into that facet, like one facet of the jewel that mm-hmm. we bring along.
Right.
And it's interesting, as you say, after you come out of the silence, the experience, I guess, can be profound.
You know, there's a saying of Rumi's, I think, where he says, you know, I'm not a Muslim, I'm not a Christian, I'm not a Hindu, and you can go through all the rest of the things that you're not. When you tap into that ultimate reality, all those labels disappear.
Yeah.
And when you come back, you have to say something if you're going to say anything. So you choose the language that's most comfortable. So like I said, Judaism is my mother tongue.
Right.
And that's the language I default to.
But
I still realize that now I'm talking about something that I was living a moment ago, and that shift from talking about to actually experiencing is huge.
Yes, and this thing is larger than ourselves, and helps to connect us to each other in a way that is beyond words. If you try to speak it, it will be kind of reduced. But you've written so much poetry, and I find that poetry is one of those ways to express the, you know, in unfathomable or ineffable, or that is beyond us, in a way that others, you know, through imagery, perhaps, in a different kind of rhythm or a different meter that can cross over more to that place.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I don't consider myself a poet, though you're right. I publish lots of poetry. I write mostly prose, but I do think that poetry, because of the nature of that art, given the rhythm and the playfulness of the language, and even printed poems on a page, you can play with the typeset and the way the layout is. There's so many ways to go beyond language using language when you're working in poetry that is sort of absent when you're working in prose. But I think the poets like Rumi and others are those who can point more directly to this ultimate reality of which each one of us is a part.
Yes, and in a way that many people across traditions can relate to. That's where folks go like that. Now, even though you're rooted in Judaism, you're profoundly committed to human relations, and the phrase I think you've used is beyond religion. How did this ecumenical fire become a passion in your lifetime?
Well, that's a question. I don't know if I can actually pinpoint any experience that would lead me in that direction. What I mean by beyond religion is what we've been talking about, that there's a reality that no religion can encompass, that all of them at their best point to, you know, religion at its best points beyond itself, but normally it points just at itself. So beyond religion is trying to get, you know, outside the box and see what the larger reality is. But I don't know if I could tell you that, oh, this happened and that's why I think that way. It's just sort of been my experience since I can remember.
And that seems to be a peacemaking venture from where I'm standing, that, you know, your commitment to, you know, sort of not being imprisoned by one's faith or not being so boxed in that we can't be compassionate or relating to others in this world, in this time, seems to be, to me, a peacemaking endeavor on your part, and we'll get more into that as well in a little bit. Where do you see faith going? Where is your hope? What is your vision of future
faith? Those are different things. Where do I see it going? What's my hope and what's my vision? I mean, right now, I see it going in the wrong direction. I just see the more global we get, the more fearful we become of the other, and the more we seem to be circling the wagons. Now, that can be where I live. You know, I live in the Bible Belt, and there's a lot of that here, and maybe that's not true in other places. But so what I see and where I see faith going from where I live, my, you know, just actual geographical location, is not optimistic.
Okay.
People are frightened, and they're frightened of the other. And when we fall into that trap, we are so easily manipulated by clergy and politicians working in concert. So there's a real fear I have that we are going in the wrong direction, that our brands are just becoming more and more armed and dangerous, in a sense.
Have you felt persecuted in your journey?
No, not me personally.
Okay.
No, I mean, I've had people tell me I'm going to hell, but anyone who isn't a certain kind of believer will have someone tell them that.
Right.
You know, I think. I mean, there's persecution that actually robs you of your rights that I have not experienced. There's the kind of intellectual or pseudo-intellectual bullying or theological bullying that people try to pull. And that really, I think, only has an impact if you believe what the other person's saying. Since I don't believe in hell, going there is really not my problem.
Right.
But I haven't done that. But where I live, the Muslim community certainly has.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Right. I was just going to say we're the epicenter of, you know, a lot of the anti-Islam movement in the United States.
Well, it's very interesting what you bring up, because I would say, you know, over the years, I mean, like the centuries, everyone has been rather separated from each other and sort of able to stick to their own in a way that the world has opened up lately. And you mentioned like circling the wagons. I think we're living at a very interesting time, whether it's through communication or technology, where we don't really have that cut-off thing between human beings anymore. And perhaps right now we're, you know, they're circling wagons, and perhaps that circle is going to turn around to face someone else at some point, and we have to go through these sort of birth pangs, you know, as like St. Paul says. This is sort of a childbirth time, and we're going to go through some bad things before we come out the other side. I don't know that it's necessary, but, you know, my perception of this is that we're not going to see any less interest in God or less interest in religion, nor are we going to find anything more unified, but perhaps we're going toward a path of understanding. This is happening in ignorance right now, I believe. You know, the kind of prejudice, the kind of book burning, the kind, you know, without ever reading the book, that kind of thing that's going on. But it seems like what we've been doing here for years is trying to address this exactly, which is the sort of tolerance through education, by talking to each other, by finding out what people believe and why. And, you know, we talk enough, and basically we wind up, you know, in that moment where we realize we're on the same page. Some deeper level, beyond these things that people fight about, as you say. So now, as a rabbi, though, I mean, you're very committed to this. How is this sort of broader view or these principles conveyed, like, say, for example, through your congregation? Does it touch their lives as well?
Well, I don't have a congregation. So I did for 20 years, but that was a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
So no, I teach at the university. I lecture around the country and sometimes, like this summer, around the world.
Right.
And I write books. But no, the congregation, I no longer am in that part of the world. But since I do travel to a lot of congregations,
right,
I would say that there is a growing interest among people, whether they're in a synagogue setting or a church setting or, you know, wherever else I might go, there's a growing interest among people, certain people, in, I don't know, world religion, comparative religion, spirituality beyond religion. There is a real curiosity, and I think that, you know, you were saying that education is key. So that's, you know, we liberals always say that. So I agree with that. that if people only were better educated. Mm. And what one of the things that gives me hope is the fact that here in Middle Tennessee, at Middle Tennessee State University, I mean, we have, we just got a full-time professor in comparative religion who's going to make that a center of the department's work and philosophy, and the courses, and I've been teaching that for years, and the courses always fill up. So there are students, you know, young people who are very interested in finding out what the other religions are about. Some of them are doing it because they see themselves as sort of studying the enemy, but many of them are actually curious, and some of those are actually seekers who are trying to get beyond this circle the wagons thing. I think that ultimately, I guess this is my hope, ultimate hope, is that while we'll never see an end of wagon circling, I think there are certain people who are just, that's where they're at. And there will always be people at that level. But I think that there are others who are, it's almost like, you know, this is sort of a silly thing maybe, but it's almost like mysticism is becoming normative,
right,
among a certain segment of the population and a growing segment of the population. And some of that is just new age silliness, but some of that is, you know, a deep commitment to different contemplative practices that are taking people beyond the creedal formulas of these brand name religions and simply dropping them into the greater sea of divine reality. And they realize that there's no, the reality itself will hold them up. They don't have to, you know, take refuge in one raft or one boat or another. And that's something that gives me hope. My vision ultimately is for, you know, people to focus on those spiritual practices that will lead the majority of us to a realization that reality, truth, is beyond anything we can articulate, and it makes us humble, and it should simply bond us together in our humble approaches to make life as godly as possible, as opposed to making other people's lives as hellish as possible somehow, and then saying somehow that's in the service to my God or my faith.
Mm. Yes, thank you so much. I agree. We're definitely seeing much more of that, the mystical or the prayerful or, you know, something larger than our particular boxes emerging these days as a bridge to each other. We are about halfway through the program. Stay on the line. We're just going to take a very quick break. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation with Rabbi Rami Shapiro. Let's spend a minute now with a new favorite. Stay with us. I'm wide awake. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're talking about tolerance and moving beyond the boxes of our religions with award-winning author Rabbi Rami Shapiro. Now, Rami, if folks have joined us right now in the program, I just want to recap a little that we've experienced in our years of the program this emergence of mysticism, as we were talking about, as a kind of common language or bridge between faiths worldwide. Can you please speak just a little more to the role mysticism plays in religious tolerance?
Well, I think if you look at the great mystics of the different world's religions, none of them seem to be at the center of these violent kinds of episodes that we see religions falling into. Mystics tend to, I define mystic this way. Let's start with that. A mystic is a person who is not satisfied with talk about God, but wishes to have a direct encounter with God, and then in parentheses, God as defined by whatever tradition they're working in. So the word God may not even appear in their tradition, like in Buddhism or certain kinds of Buddhism. So don't take God too literally here.
Right.
But they're not satisfied with talking about ultimate reality, but they want to experience it directly. And when they do, not even going to the point of saying, oh, they're enlightened, but even if you just tasted it, which I would say I have tasted it, that simple tasting of that ultimate reality makes it impossible to label the other as other exactly, that say, okay, they don't believe like me, so they are the enemy, or they are a problem, or they are a threat to my culture or my worldview or, you know, whatever.
Right.
Because I think mystics just step beyond all of that, and they realize that we're really part of a non-zero-sum game, that reality is all-embracing, and it's not divvied up by who's got the right, you know, who wears the right team jersey or who's marching for the right flag or who's got the right belief system, that it's just not the way the universe is structured. So mystics, it's beyond tolerance. Mystics have a deep respect for all beings because they recognize that we're all part of the same being, if you like, with a capital B.
Right. And it's interesting to me that on the one hand, you know, more of the historical worldly sense, we have the institutional church, as it were. I mean, temple, you know, whatever tradition you may have. And then the mystics sort of follow along that timeline and in many ways can be sort of the antidote to some of the troubles that that the worldly organized religion can get into, I find.
Well, I mean, look, I'm very prejudiced here. So I would say that when we're talking about the institution of religion, the institution has only one aim, and it has nothing to do with truth. I mean, the aim of the religious institution is to maintain itself and to grow itself. That's usually part of it. And that requires money, and it requires power and control. And these are just not things that mystics, as I understand mysticism, these are not things that mystics are interested in.
Right. No, I agree and relate to that. I've had a saying that, you know, whenever we're in the parish, everything becomes about the church roof. And the money that, you know, I mean, I'm not being facetious. It's a realistic concern that people focus on the funds and the money, and therefore it tends to affect how they preach, what they share, not wanting to alienate people. It's very real, and so often in mystic tradition, they basically are working outside or have kind of walked away from that.
I know so many clergy in the Jewish world and in the Christian world, just to stick with those two, who are so depressed because what they believe to be true isn't what they can preach from the pulpit.
Right.
And it's because if they do that, they think they'll lose their jobs.
Yeah. And isn't that a shame? Because, you know, that's what really enlivens and puts the fuel into people is to speak the truth and share that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. That gives one pause for a moment there. So when, if I may ask, did this have anything to do with your not staying within a congregation?
No. I actually started my own congregation in 1978, I think, as I was still in rabbinical school. Maybe it was closer to 80, but whenever it was, I started my own because I just couldn't imagine stepping into a place where my ideas would be so shocking to the community that I might have to, you know, hold back. So I created my own synagogue, starting with friends who knew what I thought. And then as the synagogue grew, we had a sort of a rule, an unwritten rule, but you couldn't actually join the synagogue until you sat with me personally and I explained where we were coming from and how we drew from a number of traditions, Judaism being our root, but, you know, this is in Miami, Florida, and at a wonderful place that's still there called Temple Beth Or. And we had, through gracious donations, we built a beautiful walking meditation garden, and I contacted Thich Nhat Hanh and told him what we were doing, and we were basing it on, you know, his walking meditation practice, and he sent us a sister who spent Shabbat with us and helped us dedicate the walking meditation garden. So we really integrated different religious practices and ideologies into the umbrella of what we were doing. We were grounded in Judaism, but our roots were in Judaism, but our branches were much broader than that. So if you weren't comfortable with that, then luckily it was Miami, and there are numerous synagogues all around that you can find the place to be more comfortable in. So I didn't leave because of that. I left because I was interested in, I mean, my writing has sort of taken over my life, and the traveling that I was doing for that was becoming bigger and bigger, and I wasn't able to serve the congregation the way a rabbi ought to serve. So I said I had to leave. I needed someone who could focus on them, not focus on, you know, being a big literary rock star.
Sure. Well, thanks. Thank
that
you for your
work,
candor.
But
still, now I've found a document, a kind of manifesto that I appreciate. It's called the Neti Neti document.
Yeah.
And can you share a little about what that is? People can find it on your website. I've got it up in front of me. Would you share a little bit of where that came from and what the hope is for it? It's an open letter to peoples of faith.
Yeah, the Neti Neti is Sanskrit for not this, not that.
Okay.
And the idea is that what I wanted people to do. You know, there's all these wonderful manifestos floating around, like Karen Armstrong's Charter for Compassion. And,
right.
You know, we all pledge to make the golden rule the center of our lives, and I think that's fabulous. And I just wanted to add to that mix. So I came up with this, and the idea is to recognize that all of our scriptures are of human origin and that none of them are absolutely true, and all of them contain pearls of truth, and that we really need to free ourselves from being bound to any scripture or any interpretation of scripture, but free to investigate any scripture to find the truth that are within it. In a nutshell, that was the idea there.
Yes, and it's a very nice, nicely worded document. We believe God transcends theology, that no idea about God can adequately encompass the reality of God. True, that's what we were sharing before.
Yeah.
We believe that revelation is not given to a people, but through a people to the world. And we believe that the truth in each scripture is common to all scriptures. The truth, yes, the truth within each scripture is common to all scriptures, calling us toward justice, compassion, humility, dignity, respect, love for both person and planet, and the transcending of self through service to others.
See, I would sign that.
Yeah, yeah, I would sign that, too. That's a very kind of bottom line, right?
And, well, I thought so.
And I like the, we call upon peoples of every faith to liberate the wisdom of God from the xenophobia of tribe and ego, and to free religion from fear and violence by distinguishing the holy from the merely sacred. Can you expand on that thought a little bit? What distinguishes the holy from the merely sacred?
Well, I think that different communities have different understandings of what's sacred and what isn't. So, for example, when there's a printed Quran, well, that's a sacred text to Muslims.
Right.
And disrespecting that book, not just intellectually, but I mean physically disrespecting that book, is a violation of what they consider sacred to a Christian or a Jew as such. I don't mean just as a person who cares about and respects other people's beliefs, but,
right.
You know, the Quran is not part of my tradition, so a printed Quran is no more sacred than a printed volume of Shakespeare.
Right.
Whereas a handwritten Torah scroll has the same, you know, sense of sacredness to it that a Quran may have to a Muslim. So different communities will define different things as sacred. But the holy is, to me, at least the way I meant to use it, was more universal, that we're going beyond the things that we fetishize in our different religions to something that we all recognize as being holy, which would be life and treating one another with respect. I mean, those kinds of things.
Right.
And so that's what I meant by making that distinction.
Hmm. Yes, and getting to a place where we, you know, see God in others, in all others.
Yeah, right.
When the barriers come down, even if we, as you say, you know, can speak from our own tradition, that doesn't necessarily mean we disrespect another. We can see the holy and the love in other families, and that these things are just so primary to all of us.
Right, and I'm sure most of the people listening in know people of different religions who actually share with them this deep experience of the holy.
Yeah.
Even though you hold different things sacred, but the holy is something else. I mean, I love hearing, I mean, I was just in Rome, so I love hearing Catholics speak the Catholic language.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mean Italian. I mean the Catholic theological language.
Yeah.
I just love that. Now, I hear it differently than I'm sure a Catholic does, but I don't want them to water that down. I don't want them to make it other than it is, but I want to see it, at least for me, I want to see it in a broader perspective that it's talking about in its own, that, you know, it's in its own dialect. It's talking about this universal reality. So they might see it as Trinitarian, and I might see it some other way, but there's something that I need to learn about the Trinity that will enhance my experience of divinity. Mm. So it's just nothing is alien.
Right.
It's just another language.
Hmm. That's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. Yes, I can relate to that, too. Now, One River Wisdom School, how's that going? Can you share about it?
Yeah, well, that's really not how you knew about that. Did I mention that in something? Yeah, that's in the very early stages. I'm working with Kathy Woods and Gordon Pierman, who are wonderful. Kathy is a phenomenal Qigong teacher, and Gordon is a therapist and an Episcopal priest and a Buddhist meditation teacher of mindfulness. And I've known both of them for a very long time. They're husband and wife. And we have been looking at training people in interspiritual direction.
Right.
Trying to give people a grounding in mindfulness practice, in Qigong, and in the wisdom texts of the world's religions,
right.
Which is sort of where my focus is. So over a 2-year period, through a series of online encounters, but also face-to-face retreats in Suwannee, Tennessee, at a wonderful retreat center called St. Mary's, we want to explore practices and wisdom texts from the world's religions that will ground us in being able to enter into that silence that we were talking about earlier, and
yeah.
then seeing how the silence manifests to us as individuals, and learning how to guide other people into that silence and how to hold the space where they can be moved by it. And one of the things that I think may be happening in the world of religion is that as more and more people move out of the branded religion box,
right.
and there's, that spiritual but not religious kind of effort that's happening around the world, but certainly around the United States, 55 million people identify as spiritual but not religious,
right.
they're not going to be comfortable going to a branded clergy. Because if I go to a Catholic priest for guidance, I'm going to get Catholic guidance. If I go to a rabbi, I'm going to get Jewish guidance. But so many of us now are not looking for that. I want to know not a specifically labeled way of being in the world. I want to know what God is calling me to, or use another word, what reality is calling me to, what
the universe,
life is calling me to,
broader.
The universe is right,
yeah.
calling me to. And I want to be able to go to someone who knows how to help me stand in that place of not knowing, so that I might come to a sense, at least a preliminary sense of knowing where I'm being called.
Mm.
And so we're looking to train people in that. But we do start, I think, in March. First
and is that, a training for personal use, or is that a training for folks to go out there and become teachers?
Both. We're trying to avoid the idea of, well, now you're certified to
right.
do something.
Exactly. That's another brand.
Now I've created another brand.
Right.
But I am expecting that this is for your personal use, but that we're keeping it in such or teaching in such a way that you can then share it with someone else. And that we'd end up with just communities of people holding sacred space for one another without labeling it.
And, the phrase that you mentioned there, the place of unknowing or not knowing, is very powerful, because that's also one of the things that's different from, the traditional, sort of organized religious viewpoint is to be in the place of unknowing. And as Peter Gabriel said, only in uncertainty are we naked and alive. And
right.
I find that I think for those who might be a little fearful of the uncertain, there's a really strong place for your basic parish, ministry. There's comfort in there and strength in the, in the repetition of services and knowing the, liturgical year, and, knowing what's coming and how to celebrate it. There's definitely a place for that. But for those who might be reaching for something else that is, venturing a little more into the unknown, the greater self, or the greater experience of spirituality, yes, then, obviously a place like One River Wisdom School would be, phenomenal.
To me, the Book of Job provides one of the best images of what we're talking about, where at the end of the book, Job finally gets the fact that there are no answers, and there is no certainty, and there is no security, and all you can do is sit in the madness of God's presence, that whirlwind, and take comfort. English Bibles tend to screw this up. They say he hates himself, or I despise myself.
Mm.
And then he mourns in dust and ash. But the Hebrew basically says that he repents his egoic demand for answers and takes comfort, not despises, but takes comfort in being dust and ash. You know, the physicality of the world manifest in this, or the consciousness of the divine manifesting in the physical world of dust and ash. He realizes that in the end, and that brings him great comfort, but no answers. No answers. And that's, I think that's where a lot of us are going. We realize that we can only witness the madness, stand in that place of not knowing, and then, you know, be addressed by whatever that wild divine reality is.
Right.
Another text that really moves me is Elijah, where, you know, he goes through the earthquake and God is not in the quake and God is not in the fire, but then he hears this voice of sheer stillness, which is sort of a paradoxical way of articulating that deep place of meditative awareness.
Right.
And then he's questioned there, and there's only one question, unlike Job. There's only one question, that's, what are you doing here? And I understand that to mean that when you enter into that place of really not knowing and being confronted by reality with a capital R rather than use the word God, let's use the word reality, there's a question there, and it's, what are you doing? What are you doing with your life? How are you bringing holiness and godliness and love and compassion and justice into the world? You know, and I think that's the, when the mystic enters into that divine encounter, she hears that question and returns to the world to be a vehicle for justice and compassion. And it's of a piece. That's just how it works. And that's how you can tell in our various scriptures and in various religious traditions which aspects of any given tradition are coming from that place of divine encounter and which are not. And it's not hard to tell. You know, in the Hebrew Bible, when we're told to love our neighbor as ourselves, that's coming from a place of divine encounter.
Right.
When we're told 2 seconds later to wipe out every man, woman, child, and cow of our enemies, that's coming from somebody who's got nothing to do with God, who's simply using God as a stick or as a goad to raise up armies. Because it's not so easy to get people to commit genocide.
Oh, and I know that, I know.
You have to convince them that God or the state or whatever their God is, with a lowercase g, demands it. So, you know, there's this wonderful, I don't think it's actually in Dostoevsky. I think people just say it's in the Brothers Karamazov, but there's this, you know, anecdote supposedly that he wrote that without God, all things are permitted. But I think that's backwards.
Hmm.
I think it's with God all things are permitted, because without God, I've got to decide what's right or wrong, and I know genocide is wrong. But with God saying, you've got to wipe these people out, these people are your enemies, they have to be destroyed, they're heretics, they're whatever it is, then you can convince me to do stuff that I wouldn't normally do. So I think it's with God, and I would use God broadly to include any ideology. It doesn't have, you know, it could be the Stalinist state, you know, the communist state. But with an overarching ideology like that, you can be convinced to do anything. And that scares the crap out of me.
Right. That initial quote that you mentioned sounds more like, without God, there are no consequences for your actions. And I don't know that I would agree with that at this point either. You know, it's funny, another quote that came to mind as you were speaking is the one you mentioned Shakespeare earlier, and the, you know, there are greater things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. I get comfort by the mystery.
Yeah.
By the not knowing. And I think, as you mentioned, yes, people are heading more into that area. Now, something else you mentioned in one of your works is the interest in integrating body, heart, soul, and mind. Could you speak a little more to this integration in our spiritual practice and in relation to our kind of daily life?
Yeah, I think that there's a tendency, and this isn't true across the religions, but among some, and that we sort of denigrate the body. It's sort of a Gnostic idea that the physical is bad and the spiritual is good, and that we should somehow put the body down so we can liberate the spirit. And I don't think that's the way it works. I think you have to actually integrate body, heart, mind, and soul in a in a single practice. So for me, just to make it clear, if I could say what I do. So for me, my daily contemplative practice always starts with walking, and lots of walking, I mean miles of walking. And I integrate, the body is moving in a rhythm. And I don't walk slowly, I walk at a good pace. So there's a real rhythm going. It makes my breath pick up a certain pattern. And then I move, as my body is moving that way, it just sort of, it feels like it falls into a rhythm that matches the rhythm of the world. So it's sort of seamless walking through the world. Then I add to that chanting. And the chanting opens the heart. This is how I understand chanting. Chanting is a vibratory practice, and it absolutely opens the heart. And I don't mean the physical organ. I mean, the emotions, moving from fear to love.
Yeah.
It opens the heart. And then as that happens, I begin to, I don't want to overstate it, but sort of dialogue with the divine as I experience her, in my case. And I find that she's presenting ideas, and I'm not saying they're coming from inside, outside, it doesn't really matter to me, but all kinds of nuances of reality are just sort of popping into my head, and I'm not analyzing them because that takes me out of the whole experience, but I am aware of them. And as all this is happening, eventually I end up in a place of stillness and silence. Sometimes I just stop on the walk, sometimes the walk takes me to where I normally do my sitting meditation, so I sit. And then there's silence, and that's where the soul opens up. And the soul is that place where, that I-thou place, where I really feel this, because there's an I still there, there's still a sense of Rami there, where I feel this, the interconnectedness of everything, that I'm a part of all things, and all things are a part of me. So that's, if that makes sense, integrating body, heart, mind, and soul.
Yeah.
But there's a fifth level of consciousness in Judaism called spirit, and Judaism has, I won't give you the Hebrew, but we go through these four. Then there's spirit, and spirit is when I'm gone, the ego is gone, there's no Rami left whatsoever, and so there's no experience that I can talk about. But after it's over, there's what we call a reshimu, or a fragrance of the experience, and it's always one of joy and love. So integrating it, the physical into the spiritual, I think is crucial. And a lot of religions do it. I mean, look at the way Muslims pray. I mean, I was just in Turkey. I went to mosque several times.
Yeah.
And I love just the body aspect of it. And you find similar things in Catholicism, similar things in Hinduism and Buddhism.
Right.
And in Judaism. So there's not that religions have rejected the physical, but I think that some of us who, especially maybe the spiritual but not religious, it's sort of, there's a tendency anyway to promote spirit as opposed to body, and I think you have to integrate them all.
Right, right. I mean, that's what we have, right, is this body to work with, and are these hands to work with and to love others.
Yeah, take the Song of Songs in the Bible, for example.
Right.
And that's erotic love poetry that has been de-physicalized, spiritualized. So now it's about, in Judaism we say it's about God and Israel, and
right.
In the Catholic world, the Christian world, it's about, Christ and his church. Mm. No, it's not. It's about two people deeply in love who are experiencing this ecstasy that only physical bodies can know. And yeah, I think there's a spiritual component, but not at the expense of the physical.
Right, right. And seeing that divine love, that fire in each other, that's larger than anything around them, that's their access now through which they see the world.
We need to reclaim and honor that tantric element in all these traditions.
Yes, yes, definitely. That kind of passion, I can relate to that too, because that's where my work is, the divine love in relationships in my book.
Yeah.
And the saint's guide to relationships is what they shared. Now, Rami, as we come to the end of the interview, I do want to let listeners know that all of your website and contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at godspeedinstitute.com. And I wanted to thank you so much for being on the program and sharing from your great experience and wisdom and your hopes. And I hope you stay in touch. I'd like to share one of my a tip for your spiritual tool belt out there for your listeners that you wrap around yourself each day. If you can hang on, Rami.
Okay, thanks. This was delightful care. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Now, this speaks a little to what we were exploring today as well. The two mystics, St. Teresa and John of the Cross, were friends, contemporaries, and fellow workers. They were of the same order and sharing a common purpose and degree of sanctity, but in almost every other aspect, they were as unlike companions as two saints could possibly well be. And I want to share this with you because their relationship speaks to the workplace and the kind of difficulties we can encounter with people and how they handled theirs. With folks like Francis and Claire of Assisi that we shared about last week, we saw how two soulmates, so two people so clearly alike in thought and intent, could light up the world through their love and galvanizing expression of faith. Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross would also set the spiritual world on fire, but they were so completely different in so many ways. We might consider them like a veritable model of the Jungian complements, anima and animus, or yin and yang, or the paradoxical union of opposites. Science tells us that when it comes to matter or substance, like attracts like, but when it comes to magnetism or electricity, opposites attract. Teresa was an older woman, John a younger man, yet he called her daughter and she called him father. She was of Jewish heritage and he Arabic. She came from affluence, he came from poverty, yet he was formally educated, she was not. His writing is refined, elegant, and scholarly. Her writing is rustic, straightforward, and vernacular. He writes in broad, impersonal terms. She writes from deep personal experience. John was not known for having any administrative ability and was not given assignments involving organizational skills or negotiation. Teresa was an effective negotiator and very worldly administrator. John was a model of self-control and self-discipline. Teresa was motherly and doting, often seeking assurance and comfort. John would master detachment from the material things of this world that can entrap. Teresa would master detachment from personal ties that bind. They were both obedient. And she says in a letter that Teresa wrote writing about John, "I believe our Lord has called John to this task. There's not a friar who does not speak well of him, for he had been living a life of great penance, even though he's young. It seems the Lord is watching over him carefully, for although in trying to get everything settled, we met with a number of troubles, and I myself must have caused trouble at times by becoming annoyed with him, yet we never saw an imperfection in him." I want to just comment on that because there's very useful information there in their work together in reforming the Carmelite order. Teresa believed that John of the Cross was always a saint and referred to his saintliness in her correspondence, usually adding others supporting witness of John's holiness. However, when they worked together as colleagues, she found qualities in him that annoyed her. And her correspondence indicates that she made her annoyance known, perhaps adding another layer of difficulty to the situation. This is because they had the different personality types and different skill sets while working together. Yet, what they were able to do was to develop a system based on their skills. Teresa would found the institutions, handle the real estate, legal matters, construction, and financial procurement. Then she turned over the responsibility of spiritual formation of the friars to John. So they were both supreme architects, Teresa, the external architect, and John, the interior. In this way, Teresa and John, with their myriad of opposite skills and qualities, formed a complete wholeness of talent, filled the gaps and wanting places in each other, and with a singleness of effort, move their entire community of colleagues forward. I want to thank you for joining us on the Godspeed Institute today. this program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City. Our guest was Rabbi Rami Shapiro, and the show was produced by Michael Hallenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.